Looking to refresh your closet, home, or beauty routine this spring? Walmart's got all the stylish goods in one stop. From chic new looks and the latest makeup to quality furniture and tableware. Go to walmart.com/nowtrending. That's walmart.com/nowtrending for the hottest fashion, home, and beauty finds. Your style at Walmart.
Hello, and welcome to a spooky episode of Saturday Night Shoggy. Today, I am joined by my lovely co-hosts, V-Lord and Sakaki. Say hello.
Hello.
Hi. When did Berrigan become British?
This is one of my many talents.
What's the Xenoblade?
Yeah, I'm actually Welsh. Did you know that?
Makes so much sense now. Marion's the secret rare blade in Xenoblade 2.
Okay, alongside our usual co-host, we have a very special guest, Lum Ranmayasha. Say what's up, Lum.
Hello, and I'm here to exercise you, you Welsh Valentine's vampire, with your off-seasonal intro. I've got the mirror in my hand that sees through the horrors inside you. I'm through the other side of this mic. I will exorcise your monsters and stomp them out so we can have a normal podcast discussion on these lovely stories from Rumiko Takahashi.
I'm melting!
We're disintegrating into monsters! Oh, it's so disgusting and nauseating. We gotta stop all these monsters. There's nothing left of Marion but their clothes.
That was kind of effed up.
Well, it's as messed up as the stories in the book, or the first story in the book.
Yeah, today's episode is going to be about Came the Mirror and Other Tales by Rumiko Takahashi. We had to get the Takahashi expert from Manga Mavericks.
Oh, thank you. I will say I am an enthusiast. I don't know if I can claim to be an expert when we have the good folks at like Rubik World out there and like so many like longtime diehard Takahashi fans. You know, I was just on a stream with Brent and Jordy and the rest of the Lum Squad crew, who is like showing a huge collection of UI merch, and it's like I couldn't even hope to compare in terms of that kind of collection. So you know, but no, I am a huge enthusiast and lover of Takahashi's works, and it is so exciting to get another one of her short story collections available out here and localized. It has been nearly 24 years since the last release of one of Rumiko Takahashi's one-shot collections in the US. One or Double came out in like July of 1998, so it has been a long time. And this book in particular, as far as the Japan side goes, it was the first new release in the Rumik World imprint of Takahashi short story collections in 20 years. Whereas Wonder Double came out in Japan in 1995, and then Came the Mirror came out in 2015. So, yeah, I mean, it's been a long time coming. And, yeah, like, it's cool to just have another collection of Rumiko World stories. And there are a lot of, you know, other releases from Takahashi in terms of one-shot collections in the Rumiko Theater series that I would love to see them license. And, you know, I would love to see them republish the older Rumiko World and Rumiko Theater collections. And hopefully, if this book does well, and with as all in on Takahashi as they've been doing, hopefully we will see that come to pass. But this is a great first start.
Inject all of it into our veins.
Yeah, just turn us all into parasites.
Giving people the heebie-jeebies on the inside since 2015.
Mm. I actually was wondering when this came out, and I did notice at the end when I saw the I forgot what that page is called, the credits page. Mm-hmm. I don't know, because I was like, oh, this is
It's an interesting story. It reminded me a little bit of, I don't know why. So the vibe I got from these short stories reminded me a lot of, oddly enough, Beyond Your Belief, Factor Fiction. Beyond Belief, Factor Fiction, hosted by Jonathan Frakes. Because a lot of it like veers between like horror and suspense and also humor.
Yeah.
And like you know, that way that Takahashi does.
Yeah.
Which is like,
it's very goosebumpy, but for more an adult audience, you know. A lot of these are published in big comic, so for more an adult crowd. But the main distinction between Rumic World and Rumic Tito collections, that's the Rumic World collections do also contain Shonen Sunday and her Shonen one shots. So we do have like two from Sunday in particular. But yeah, this is like generally a collection of horror stories. And like pretty much annually, Takahashi does write a new one-shot alongside her, you know, current serialization, usually in big comic. And usually these works tend to be horror themed. I think that she likes to use them as a way to explore ideas and subject matter she can't quite do, wouldn't be like totally appropriate to do in whatever she's working with at the time. So especially like, you know, we're seeing, you know, more slice of lifey kind of stories, particularly like in the stories that ran during the Inuyasha era. And then we see like more hard horror type stories during the Rene era in terms of the stories in this collection. And it's pretty cool to see. I had read a few of these before just individually when people translated. Just half of these I'd read before. Revenge Doll, Kingdom Mirror, and Sweet Sunday when people translated them. But it's cool to like have the collection out and like read all this. These stories in this book and have some new stories from Takashi that I hadn't read before, which is really nice. But yeah.
Nice.
Okay. I mean, I will say that this is the first time I've really read. Well, no, I've read one of her collections, but a little bit of Macho and Dinner. But obviously, that's in Japanese, so I don't understand everything. But
yeah,
so this would be my first time reading one of her collections in English, and it definitely still very much has her vibe. Because as I was reading through it, I was like, "Yeah, this is definitely only a thing Takahashi would do." But it does have that air. It does have this kind of like vibe that you wouldn't get from like the Sunday works. Like the one that did run in Sunday did feel something like I was
Rama.
Describing it.
I mean, it is very Rama-esque. Yes, the main protagonist's fear of cats, the strange tsundere relationship between him and the female lead. Yeah. I mean, the transformation gimmick too. Yeah. It's very like, oh, this is kind of like a return to kind of Rama motif. Which I found pretty interesting.
I was describing it to Jack as Garfield with Ranma. But, like, yeah, that one felt like a Ranma. It would be a Ranma episode. So, but the one that I guess what surprised me most, I won't go too much into detail because we'll probably talk a lot about it, is just the My Sweet Sunday between her and Adachi. That I saw it on the table of contents, but I wasn't expecting what it ended up being. And it had to be my favorite part of this anthology.
I think that's the other thing we gotta talk about is that not only is this like the first like short story collection from Takahashi published by Viz in over 20 years, like this ends up being kind of the first like a publication of one of Mitsuru Adachi's manga they've done since they finished Cross Game. Because Sunday is a collaboration manga between Adachi and Takahashi exploring their relationship to Shonen Sunday and how they came up as manga creators and how interconnected their journeys were. And yeah, it's just Takahashi and Adachi kind of going back and forth in terms of outlining, drawing out their lives, culminating in their fateful meeting over beef hot pot in 1982. So yeah, it's really awesome that in the process of releasing this book, we also have a new Adachi manga localized for the first time in nearly 10 years when the last volume of Cross Game came out. So it is very much welcome. And of course, this short story, this one shot was published to commemorate the 50th anniversary of Shonen Sunday back in 2009, which very appropriate to have like Adachi and Takahashi kind of both draw out and talk about their relationship to Sunday as like the two creators who probably like really made it what it is known for today.
Mm-hmm. The king and queen of Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
I like that Adachi kind of name drops Aoyama though.
No, he like, acknowledges Aoyama is like, yeah, no, Aoyama is a big dog too. But like, yeah.
Yeah, he does.
I mean, if those are king and queen, Aoyama is God.
I mean, it kind of goes back to the interview that I translated with Aoyama and Adachi way back where, yeah, even there Adachi kind of acknowledges, yeah, you've had... Mm-hmm. He's of course very humble, like he is in this too, where he's like, I've just been doing the same thing for like 30 years. You're the one that's actually pioneering doing new things.
Yeah, no, so. He really says that, oh, it really is because of trailblazers like Takahashi that I was able to kinda ride their cultures and also make my mark in Sunday as well. Because his big debut in Sunday did come after UI was published and stuff, but also Takahashi for the longest time has always, you know, felt like, you know, Adachi's someone I need to catch up to. He's like a person whose level of work is like someone I really want to match. And it's like, you know, because she originally like saw like one of his first works published in Sunday like back when she was a kid, and you know, he's 6 years older than her, so it's like she like was aware of him all the way back then, and for the longest time she would be reading manga magazines and be thinking, oh, is this Adachi's new work? Is this Adachi? Does he's using a new pseudonym, but this is Adachi, right? And she was wrong in some of these cases, it was just different authors. But no, like she was following his career so closely for years, and he was someone she really looked up to, and she still looks up to. There was a recent translation of an interview from a Rumiko Takahashi like essay book that got translated to the Comics Journal just recently, and in that all too, like the writer was commenting about the meeting Takahashi and Aoyama or Takahashi and Adachi, and Takahashi was talking about Adachi in a very reverent way, like, man, he's like someone I still can't beat, I still can't catch up to. And it's like, it's so interesting that they have like this such long standing relationship of inspiring each other, and like they have such a really close friendship and rivalry in terms of like pushing and inspiring each other to like want to create something like as good as the other, which is so, so cool.
Yeah.
I think it's a really good thing whenever we get these kind of comics about like how the comic creators like got to where they are, especially when it comes to like interpersonal relationships with other creators, because that kind of I don't know, like that kind of content, I guess, is something that it provides a lot of context for like the trajectory in their careers, like, oh, like throughout this whole time, like Takahashi, she tried submitting works to other magazines or whatever, but then she had one comment. She's like, I think I'll go to Sunday because their readers are nicer to news. Yeah.
No, it's a super interesting look at like the magazine culture time. Like, what were the magazines and the titles that were like really turning heads and trailblazing for the time? Like the discussion of this Cole is the magazine, like the premier magazine for cultivating new manga talent that was run by Tezuka and a lot of other greats of the era that Adachi was encouraged to submit to by his brother. Like, that was super interesting, just seeing like what magazines, what creators were like really encouraging the growth of these artists, the next generation.
Yeah, especially like cool seeing like the types of manga that like Takahashi was reading.
Yeah,
I gotta say, I love seeing Joe Yabuki Takahashi style.
Oh, she is a big Yabuki Joe fan. She's a big Ashino Joe fan. There is an interview out there that I don't know if it's translated yet. Should be, hopefully someone will one day. But like, yeah, no, she's Sakaki, a big fan.
Please,
but
do
yeah,
it.
It's also what? So cute to see her like fangirl Ryuichi Kagami, and like her just like, oh, I want to be in this guy's world. His art is so cool. I want to be a manga creator. I want to go to school to meet Ryuichi Kagami, and just by chance, by enrolling Kazuo Koike's Giga Sanjuku, she had one of her first like guest speakers was Ikegami. And I love the expression she makes. She draws where she's like just smitten, just awestruck, and just has this wanting desire to like tell him she loves it. It's just so, so fun. Just to see, like, what mangaka she idolized and she fangirled over.
Yeah, I think her story is really interesting, too, because there were times where she was kind of discouraged and, like, wasn't as, like, hyper-focused on making art or whatever. Like, in college, she majored in history, but there were a lot of people that at her girls' college also really liked manga, so
yeah.
They joined the manga club, and that's what kind of reinvigorated her whole passion for it,
yeah.
Which is... It's pretty cool. It's like, it's never too late to, like, pick something back up.
No, totally. I mean, we both see Takashi Miyadachi kind of fight against their parents or fight against, like, societal expectations of, like, oh, we'll grow up to get, like, kind of normal type jobs. You know, that's the parents. Like, Tadachi frames it, his journey of, like, this is the story of how I would disappoint my parents and keep disappointing them. And it's so
interesting. I like that, you know? He throws out there, too, that his brother is, like, he was already a disappointment. So
yeah. He draws his brother's, like, whole thing, him at gunpoint and scheme out. It's like, I'm going to make a mangaka out of Mitsuru. I'm taking him with me. It's very funny. It's like, it's nice seeing his brother as such a huge point of encouragement in his life. Like, a huge, like, mentor figure, like, telling him, hey, you're really good at it. You should enter this contest. And when he saw that, oh, Adachi really has a talent, he, like, got acknowledged in the contest. He was like, oh, you know, this guy is... real potential, you know, I'm gonna help cultivate him. And that in turn encouraged him to, like, return to his own dreams of, like, being a manga artist himself, which was really nice and sweet.
And yeah, he's drawing a manga, kind of an autobiographical manga right now of him and the older brother, Tomu, is drawing one of him and his younger brother, and it's currently running in Gesson. So
yeah, so
I
really worked out.
Yeah, so that could also offer some more anecdotes and everything to, you know, his journey.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, I going back just a little bit to, you know, the formation of the Shonen magazine, there's a rich history to that. And I do think that part of the reason why Sunday was so kind to newbies at that point back then was because...
it was a newer magazine.
Yeah, it was a newer magazine. And there's this idea, like, there was... I think by the time, like, Takahashi and Mitsuru Adachi were, like, looking to get into manga, they had started solidifying what a Shonen magazine should be. Because it was a way different way back in the day. You had, like, essays. Like, the very first episode, the very first issue of Sunday actually had, like, an essay from a child psychologist in it. So they weren't really even doing manga that much until way later. I forget the guy's name. That he solidified that, hey, manga magazines should be mainly centered around, like, manga. Before that, Shonen Sunday was a magazine. The manga was, like a latter priority.
Yeah, and we saw in Adachi's story that, you know, he wasn't that interested in Sunday originally, because, like, to him, like, the real attraction was, like, the rental manga from Gekiga manga creators, you know, at his rental shop that, you know... He could submit, like, manga drawings to them, and then, like, they would, if their, like, letter or drawing got published, they could receive, like, a hand-drawn picture from the artist. So, like, that's what he was really obsessed with when he was in elementary school. And then when, you know, Sunday came out, you know, there were just other magazines that were, like, really turning heads, you know, like Calm and stuff like that. So... You know, it's interesting, but Sunday eventually would grow its reputation, like, in the 70s. Like, as Takashi would mention, they had series from Umez and George Akiyama and Shinji Mishima. Yeah. And that's where Sunday was, like, really starting to turn heads. So it's super interesting. I also like seeing that Adachi did also learn a lot of his... manga skills from Shitari Shinomori's Ultimate Manga Handbook, which I do see referenced a lot as, like, a book that a lot of manga readers really learned from that generation.
What a god.
Oh, yeah. Not only is he the most prolific manga artist of all time, comics artist of all time, really, but he also inspired generations of talent through his
books. I love that when they show off his book, you know, the Ultimate Manga Handbook, like, Adachi's talking about, what's a draft? What's a storyboard? What's a deadline? Yeah. And then, like, he's still, and it says on the side, I still struggle with this one. I still struggle to understand that one. Adachi's sense of humor just shines on through, and it's no wonder that he's been around so long, so.
Yeah.
And we could talk about how Takahashi almost ended up in Jump. Good thing that they...
Yeah, no. I think it was Torishima. It looked like she was drawing Torishima when he was saying, a very popular, famous manga editor reviewed my work. But it didn't go anywhere.
It kind of does look like Torishima.
It's so funny to think that Torishima passed on Takahashi.
Torishima just looks at his layer and is like, oh, I effed up here.
Yeah.
My bad, fam.
Maybe he made up for it by discovering Toriyama. It's timeline. Yeah, it's just such a fascinating, like, history of manga fan culture at the time, and also, like, the development of these creators as artists. And yeah, like, just their parallel journeys that ultimately end up intersecting. It's just so fascinating to just read. And especially, like, I love the motif of, like, the star that Adachi notices that is, like, the signal of, like, his eventual fated meeting to Takahashi, which is a great recurring motif as he's, like, going through every part of the story and calling back to the star that, oh, this is a single of, like, when I will meet, like, his utter, like, co-talent that is going to be, like, lifelong friend and rival in this, like, Save magazine.
Yeah, it's true. All right, Viz, you need to give us some more Adachi.
Where's a mix, Viz?
Yeah, you know, if there was a chance of any series, you would think it would be mixed, but I guess the anime didn't attract enough enthusiasm, so I don't know.
I'm gonna go cry in the corner.
Yeah, no, it's a shame. We
must go deeper and older and get Touch.
I mean, we should get Touch. Touch is a manga classic, a seminal, informative work that, you know, probably should be made available to be read officially, but I don't know if they'll take the chance on it, unfortunately.
Yeah. Also, man, the cover for My Sweet Sunday is so good. Yeah. Also, I love that it's in color, too. It's perfect.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that there a lot of these pages are in color, which is really nice. But yeah, it's also fun looking at the My Sweet Sunday cover and seeing that, wow, Adachi has like twice as many series represented as Takahashi in this, just because he's done so many works in the same amount of time that Takahashi has done, like, her... like, four big works for Sunday at this point when this was published.
Yeah, yeah. And she, at the time, this was, what, 2009, I think?
Yeah, and Inuyasha had just ended a few months before, and okay, Renee hadn't started yet.
Yeah, because, like, Takahashi did mention that I'm still thinking about what I want to do next.
Mm-hmm.
So, oh, Nichiro Togarashi, I forgot about that. You know, if there's a work that they need, they could get that. That's fairly short. So, and it just got a stage play recently, so that's...
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of, because I remember, like, oh, it had something in the works recently.
Yeah, yeah, stage play.
Adachi just needs to get one of his works to get, like, an anime that, like, really hits. Like, it's, like, really talked about, and then maybe we'll get something again, but I don't know. Yeah. Or Biz can just take a chance on, like, an older title of his, but, I mean, we are seeing more chances taken on older titles from established creators. You know, if, like, Orochi can get published, and, you know, Kazuo Mez might have more, you know, of an attraction from the same, like, you know, type of acclaimed horror mangaka in the same way, you know, Ito is. And Drifting Classroom is also fairly popular, well-regarded series. But, you know, if we can take a chance at classics like that, I mean, surely you could also try and put some effort into some of Adachi's older work, too. But, of course, like, yeah, it'll have to probably be a shorter work, because even Orochi, it's, like, only a 6-volume series.
I did find amusing that, like, Takahashi brings up Orochi at one point. I'm like, oh, hey, that's coming out in a few months.
Yeah,
good timing, guys.
It's an opportunity for Viz not to promote it at the back of the book. It's not one of the promotions that they put at the back of this volume, you know? You know, missed opportunity.
I didn't even check what are the promotions.
It's number 5 in Urusei Maizen and Mermaid. So, you know,
okay.
Other concurrent Takahashi publications. which makes sense. But yeah, you know, missed opportunity to not also promote doing that.
I guess we should transfer. We've already talked about the back of the book. I guess we could work our way backwards or just head to the top.
I mean, it's also interesting to, you know, talk about this because it is kind of like the odd story out in the collection in terms of like the other stories are fiction pieces that are all focused around a horror team or concept. This is much an autobiographical piece. I would say it is loosely thematically connected in the overall theme of the stories of like it, the stories being about the ways in which we affect each other's lives. Like if we were to prescribe and that to be the overarching theme of the book and between the collection of stories, the My Sweet Sunday does fit into that. But in terms of like the direction of the story, like the other stories focus on kind of like more negative consequences in the way we affect the others, and then the positive as well. But like the My Sweet Sunday is very much, you know, hey, Takashi and Itachi, whether they knew it or not for so long, they were like influencing each other and they were all connected through various similar things that, you know, was a shared culture between them that inspired them growing up as manga artists before they met. But yeah, like it's an interesting choice to put the story in this book, but I think it does fit in with it in terms of like kind of the broad idea of like the way in which we can affect another person's life for good or for ill.
Definitely better messaging than Majo and Dinner.
Yeah, no, better messaging than like a collection of stories about like a middle-aged elderly man wanting to hook up with younger women to the point of one story being about a guy who's trying to kill his wife to hook up with another woman.
Viz, you can just skip that collection. Yeah, we don't need that one.
You know, that one, that one's kind of a mess. Not all the stories are terrible, but like you know, there are a lot of stories where, like, it's kind of gross, this character, how this character's acting. But, yeah, no, I mean, we can work our way back to the earlier stories, and I guess, do we just want to go through them in order from the titular Kane the Mirror story? Or
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting because the way the stories are arranged for, like, the five fictional one shot is that they are all arranged in, you know, kind of descending chronological order. Like, we're kind of starting with the newest story and working our way back to the oldest. Over a period of, like, 15 years, Witcat published in 1999 and Kane the Mirror published in 2014. And it's interesting to kind of read them that way because you're kind of seeing Takashi's art, like, in its reverse progression of, like, style. So you're kind of seeing, like, more of the Renee, more, like, angular, smaller faces, smaller eye style to, like, the kind of early Inuyasha, where it's, like, it's still more of a roundness to her faces and drawings, like, bigger eyes. And it's kind of interesting to work our way back in terms of, like, the development and the progression of her style in that way. So I found that interesting.
Yeah. Even, like, the technology used in the chapters as well as progressively gets
reflection of like the times for sure.
Yeah. I actually hadn't thought about that until you said that. Like, well, it was something I kind of innately noticed, but like there's still so much Takahashi that I was just like, okay, it didn't feel like some other artists where you see their older work and you're like, that can't be that person. That looks totally different.
No, but it's like, not as dramatic.
Yeah, but reading through this, I was just like, okay, that's just Takahashi. But now that I'm flipping through it, yeah, I can definitely see the marked kind of, like, eras as, you know, like, especially with Kane the Mirror, which, yeah, Rene, you know, Mao, obviously, that's around the, you know, same period, so.
Yeah, I think the biggest difference for me was, like, jumping from Thousand Faces to Lovely Flower.
Mm-hmm.
Especially with how big that jump was. Because initially I didn't bother looking at the years of when they were published and the contents. And I was like, wait, this looks like old Takahashi. Where's my shiny new Takahashi?
Yeah, it's like a 7-year jump between Thousand Faces to Lovely Flowers. And it is crazy, yeah, like from that's like mid Inuyasha era to like early Rene era. Just how much like her style changed even just that stint of time.
Which was Lovely Flower never been like published in a physical volume before?
I don't know if these stories have been published in physical collections elsewhere before. I think Sweet Sunday probably was. And the ones of these that I had read, I just read like isolated fan translated before, so I can't really remember if like these have been published in previous collections. I don't think they have. I think this was like because this was the first like Rumic world book that came out in like 20 years. But since like some of these were big comic stories, perhaps Lovely Flower could have been in one of those, but I don't think so.
Okay.
Oh, one thing that stuck out to me with Kaim the Mirror is the protagonist names Nana Akae and Eito Izumida, 7 and 8. Mm-hmm. Which I don't know if that has any bearing to anything, but I just found it interesting.
7, 8, 9
Math with Takahashi.
Yeah, I wonder if there is like a significance to the names. I mean, 7 and 8 add up to 15, which is both of their ages. That's like the immediate thing, but like otherwise 7 is the month, July, 8 is it. It's not really referencing the period of days because it's over 9 days that the story takes place. So, yeah, I wonder.
So, I mean, but overall, like, before I read My Sweet Sunday, this was probably my favorite story.
Yeah.
Like, I think I like Takahashi a little bit more when she's doing the supernatural sort of horror versus humor. Though, that being said, I think Rama's hilarious. But, like, yeah, I think I definitely prefer this.
Yeah, and I also think that this is the strongest in concept and in how it relates to its team, because I guess let's describe the premise of this, is that in Came the Mirror, the idea is that people are randomly assigned a mirror that shows up in the palm of their hand. It appears on them at random, and no one can see the mirror on another person, but the person with the mirror can see the ugliness within other people, which takes the form of monstrous distortions on their faces and bodies. And they can hold the mirror up to those people, and they can use it to exorcise the horrors, these monsters, out of them that are inhabiting their bodies and souls. And since the monsters aren't very big or very strong, they can stomp them dead. However, the process of exorcism involves the monsters, after being destroyed, like traveling through the person's body who has the mirror, through them and out the mirror to sanctify them, purify them. And having those monsters inside you is a nauseating sensation. But it is just a societal expectation that people who have the mirrors are responsible for cleansing these horrors. And you're expected to fulfill that obligation. And so the story is about, you know, just one day, this kid, Eito, who is like going to cram school, he has a big prep test. Like, he just randomly gets killed by a guy who has been possessed by horrors. And he thinks to himself, like, oh man, like, this is my fault for not doing my job. But then he gets revived like 9 days earlier, and he meets another girl who has the mirror. And she reveals that, you know, she had also previously been killed. And the reason why is because she outed her creep middle school teacher, who was, like, taking pictures of girls changing in their school locker room with a hidden camera. And after she, like, exposed him, he stalked and killed her. And then she got revived, and then she just tried to avoid the route where he had killed her at. and she thought she was successful in that, but then he ended up trying to attack her on the day of the test, and he was a casualty of, like, his rampage. And so they worked together to basically try and figure out a way to find this guy and, exercise the horrors out of him in an effort to, like, prevent either of them from getting killed again, which they do succeed at. But then later on, they realize that this guy is killed multiple times before, even with the horrors, like, taken out of him multiple times. And so he comes to attack them again, like, all distorted and monsters again. And they barely succeed in exercising the horrors out of him, but he, like, explodes into just this mass of monsters that just, like, crowd all around them. And it's just too much for them alone to stop. Like, they collapse. And we see them hospitalized afterwards, like, with IVs attached to them, like, Nana's wearing a necklace. So, like, they were, like, on the cusp. They were, like, seriously dying to this. But the story ends with them, like, kind of just reflecting, like, you know, it was just too much for us alone to just stomp out all the horrors, all this bad stuff. But, you know, it only could be done with other people, other passersby, like, came in and, like, helped them out in, you know, taking care of their responsibility. And basically the entire kind of metaphor of the mirror in the story is, like, being burdened with knowing that something bad is happening, like, there's something wrong with another person, and then trying your best to, like, diffuse and resolve the situation, and then just having to keep having that burden of, like, it's up to you to deal with this problem that oftentimes is, like, just too much for you to handle. And you need help with that. You can't do these things alone. Like, you can't deal with, like, all the really horrible things in the world alone. You can't just put that on your shoulder. It can, like, seriously hurt you. And that's kind of the case here, is, like, in the end, like, Nana and Ato tried to take care of this guy himself, but, like, this guy is, like, a consistent problem. Like, even before he attacked Nana, he attacked and murdered other girls. Like, he is not the someone who they could just deal with on their own. He's, like, a problem that society at large needs to come together and kind of grapple with and deal with and, like, help these kids finish the job. And I think it's, like, a very important point that, like, the mirror revives everyone under the age of 18. That kind of touches upon something else, like, Takashi specifically trying to point out. It's like, you know, these are kids, like, being tasked with this responsibility of having to deal with this uncomfortable situation, with trying to deal with, like, this creep teacher who is, like, preying and assaulting girls. And they need help from adults, but, like, they are expected, just because they're the ones with the mirror and can see the badness in this guy, to deal with the situation themselves. And at the end of the story, we are seeing, notably on the bridge, it is adults who are coming in after, like, these kids have tried their best and who are, like, stomping out all the evils and who take care of, like, finishing off all these horrors. And they can only do that with the help of those people. It's really about, like, you know, the burden and responsibility is often placed on people who are see that there's a problem, but, like, they need help. They need other people to believe in them and be able to trust that they can see what they see and take care of it with them. Because, yeah, I mean, it's another important point that you can only see the horrors, like, if you have the mirror. And these other passersby, like, we aren't given a temptation. They're also people with mirrors. They're just people who, like, saw that what they were trying to do, understood what they were trying to do, and then just came to help, whether they could see them or not. And it's just important to just be able to extend that trust to people who are, like, trying to deal with a problem and difficult situation, especially young people, and lend them to trust and lend them that support and help. And I think that's a very clever metaphor that Takashi came up with through this mirror and the monster motif, in terms of, like, just the burden that we place, especially on young people, and trying to, you know, have them deal with their problems by themselves, and, like, not realizing kind of the damaging consequences that can have on them, and just that need to be able to share that burden with other people and just resolve those problems together. So, yeah, I thought it was very well articulated. And it was also very relevant social commentary, because there was a high-profile case of a school teacher who was preying on girls with a hidden camera in a locker room that happened and was reported like 10 days before the story was published in Japan. So
wow. Jesus.
It was
wow.
very, I don't think Takashi drew the story in reaction to that, but it was very really serendipitous timing when I realized that, oh crap, this came out around the same time as that incident. So yeah, no, it's very relevant social commentary, and I think very thoughtfully handled.
Yeah, I think this is easily the strongest, like, themed story in the collection. And also in terms of pacing, where, like, it feels like it is able to tell the story more naturally to its endpoint, where a lot of the other ones, I think, just, like, kind of get to the end and then have a punchline, and then that's over.
Yeah, yeah, it's kind of abrupt.
Yeah.
The other ones. I think, like, adding a bit to what Lum was talking about, I think what made the thematic impact, like, really land was the fact that the burdens that the two kids are shouldering, they're both, like, physical and emotional.
Yeah.
And to be able to confide in an adult, usually kids have trouble with that. They either have trouble, like, expressing their emotions or going out of their way to, like, look to adults to help. Towards adults to help because they either have like a rebellious streak, or they want to be independent, and they want to be so eager to prove to the world that, like, oh, I am old enough to take care of myself, or I'm capable of doing all of this on my own. But then to realize that there are times you're going to need help, and that there's no shame in really, like, asking for it. I think that's a really valuable lesson to show to yeah. a younger audience. Well, not that this was aimed at a younger audience, but if they happen to come across this, like, it's a good message.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, especially, like, not just, like, being able to ask for help, but also, like, seeing that someone is in trouble and going out of your way and recognizing they need help and joining in to do the right thing. That's why I think the scene at the bridge is, like, so, like, pointed. Just, like, the passersby will come in and, like, are exorcising the demons, like, in their place. Like, I think that is such an important point, especially because, like, all the passersby we see, they look like adults. They're, like, adults who are seeing these kids are having trouble doing this on their own. They all come in to help them share, alleviate that burden. And basically, that pretty much saves their lives, because, like, these kids are still hospitalized after this. Like, they underwent severe physical anguish in dealing with the situation, to say nothing about trauma. But yeah, no, it's very thoughtfully considered by Takashi, of, like, just, you know, when you're seeing someone in trouble, you should go out of your way, you should reach out to them, and you should, like, help them.
Yeah, like, these kids were basically forced into being, like, empaths.
Yeah.
And, like, experiencing other people's, like suffering, I guess, and, like, the stuff that they repress.
Mm-hmm.
But then what makes it moving at the end is that, like, oh, these people aren't being forced at all into that, and they're willingly, like, deciding, like, hey, I'm gonna help with that. Like, I'm gonna also empathize and, like, make sure that you don't go through this on your own.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, definitely agree with you guys in the sense that this one just feels like a fully actualized story. Like, I wouldn't be opposed to more of it, but as it is, it doesn't feel like there's more story to be told, or I don't feel dissatisfied with how it all ended. I mean, the yeah. deeper message of the fact, I mean, it even had a little bit of Takashi humor in the fact that they were brought back to life, and it was just like, the offhanded comment from Nana, I believe, was like, I think it's some kind of child, like, say, child labor law.
Yeah.
Like, it in a way, it's kind of like, it plays into what Lum was saying, and the idea of that, you know, these kids are shouldering this by themselves. But since it's such an offhanded comment, I couldn't help but just kind of chuckle at it a little bit.
Yeah, it's definitely meant to be cheeky. For sure. It's the absurdity that, like, oh, there's this clause that, like, if a kid dies on the job doing this, oh, they can get revived, you know?
Also, whenever, like, they point their hands at, like, the, like, creatures, it just reminds me of, like, the wind tunnel.
Yeah, true.
True.
It's like, yeah, they are sucking the monsters out of them and drawing it to themselves.
Meanwhile, when I read, what is this shit called again?
Revenge Doll?
Revenge Doll? Yeah, yeah, I felt like I read something and, like, I was exactly back where I started.
Yeah, Revenge Doll doesn't... Revenge Doll is one that I have also read for, and I remember really not liking it, and that has not changed because, I mean, for one thing, the protagonist is just really awful. Just, like, the worst type of scumbag. Selfish and spiteful. Just a total awful jerk of a human being who, like, goes out of his way to torture the people around him just out of pettiness, and to the point where he's considering killing someone, and in the end he is not punished. He's like, he has like this brief glimmer of maybe like changing his ways and becoming a better person that is like completely dissipated, and by the end he has learned nothing and he's just the same scum jerk that he was. And but he's not punished either. He's not punished, and that's I think where the real and satisfying thing is that, you know, we go through this entire story of just seeing just this terrible person just hurt the people around him and scheme to like hurt the people around him, and at the end, like, sure, you know, this guy, he's not working for the magazine anymore, who knows if we'll get work anymore, but it's not really punished either. He's just like kind of living kind of lazily at his home, and he's still with the girlfriend he cursed, which is really awful. Like, I just feel so bad for that woman. Like, she is like still with this guy and serving him like tea or coffee or whatever when he cursed her. It's like, this just terrible. I just really hate. Yeah, she can do so much better. She really could.
He also just looks like drug dealer Moroku.
He does.
I guess, yeah. Moroku, if he got high and just had just a very different type of life. Oh, my God. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, puffing, using that wind tunnel to get some real puffing in.
Oh,
but
God.
I will say, though, like, yeah, he's an unrepentant, awful human being. But I will say, I like that at the end, he got his own, he was the cause of his own downfall.
Right.
By putting the white out, yes.
In the end, he didn't lose anything, though, because he was losing the series no matter what.
He was
going to
kill someone.
Yeah, like what he lost is the chance to kill someone. Like, no, there was no other downfall for him, you know? Like, nothing else would have changed other than he would have killed this person. So if anything, he got spared, like, being a murderer. Even though that's what he wanted to do. But, yeah, it's just like... Yeah, it's...
He wasn't good enough to be light.
Yeah, no, seriously. It is kind of a Death Note-y premise. So, I mean, we should kind of explain the premise of Revenge Doll. Is the idea is that this 33-year-old manga artist, you know, who had a big hit when he was starting out in this magazine, but in the 10 years since, has not really been able to come up with a follow-up, and he has on his last chance, the last series, and has been told to wrap it up in 10 chapters because it's not doing very well. He's not really putting his all or any effort into his work, so that's not really making an appealing series to readers. And he's just very bitter and resentful. He thinks everyone's out to get him. He thinks, like, the editor-in-chief, who is, like, his former editor, who he got replaced on his old series, is out to get him out of, like, bad blood for, like, replacing him. And he thinks he has it out for him. He thinks that, like, his young assistant, who he later fires, you know, is, like, kind of schemed against him because, like, his series is replacing his. And his series is, like, sprung out of a one-shot that he ran, like, while his series was on break due to his own fault because he got, like, hungover and late and behind. So that's why that one-shot got published. But, you know, whatever. Like, so he's resentful to those guys, and he's also just, you know, spiteful to the people around him who are, like, not doing anything. Like, he's spiteful to his editor who like, you know, is just trying to give him advice, but, like, he, like, you know, hates his, they're not, like, taking his work seriously. And then he like hooks up with his, like, utter assistant, who's his like finisher's work, you know, just out of spite, despite like the young assistant mangaka, because he knew that kid was into her, and so he hooked up with her just to spite that kid, and now he's continuing to just sleep with her and like string her along, and then he ends up, you know, also kind of resenting her because she grinds her teeth when she sleeps or something. She criticizes his manga. Like, so, you know, he's just a total jerk to the people around him. But he receives, like, this doll that from a fan of his old work. His old work was called Revenge Doll. And when, because of that, like, the fan, like, oh, thought of him when he uncovered him while clearing out his attic or whatever. And the doll basically, you know, if you think of someone's name and you, like, blacken, you fill out the eye on the doll, and the doll has three eyes, like, that person can be cursed. And if you fill out, like, the big eye, you can, like, curse someone to death, essentially. And so he uses, like, the first eye curse on his finisher assistant, and, like, he curses her to get, like, a big sty in her eye. And then he cursed with the second eye his editor, and that caused him to get into a car accident immediately after he picked up his pages for a deadline. And the editor in chief forced that poor editor to deliver the pages before going to the hospital anyway, which was just terrible. And like, now that guy has like serious whiplash and is wearing a neck brace, and now he's thinking of using a third eye to kill someone, and he's thinking he's going to kill his editor and the editor-in-chief for, you know, canceling his series. But then the editor-in-chief visits him one night and tells him that he thinks that he doesn't have long to live and just wants him to listen to his like last request of like just putting his all into the last chapters of the series. So he ends up doing that, and the doll, like, he, you know, gets creeped out about it because, like, his assistant tries to throw it away, but it then keeps coming back, and then he tries to keep throwing it away, and so he gets creeped out of, like, using it and the idea of using it. So then he just actually does put effort into his series again, and things seem to be going better. Like, you know, everyone is happier with him, and he's happier, and he's, it seems like he's changed his ways. But then when he finds out that, you know, he is getting let go from the magazine after all, even though the series has improved and stuff, you know, he becomes resentful of his young assistant all over again. And he's like, okay, I'm going to use the doll to kill this kid after all. And he blacks out the eye, or he tries to black out the eye, but he gets into conflict with his other assistant, and instead accidentally uses whiteout instead, and that erases all the curses and destroys the doll. And so, yeah, it just ends with him, like, you know, he's just fired, and the new series is published. The editor-in-chief just had a stomach ulcer, so he's fine, so, you know.
That was the funniest part to me.
It was. Like, just, oh, yeah, casually,
just a stomach ulcer, guys.
Just so casually says it, yeah. But, yeah, like, and that's the thing about the story, is that this is a story about a guy who just did all these awful things to the people around him, and he just gets off consequence-free, really. Like, again, like, the thing, like, there is no down... The downfall he had is just all due to his own actions. Before even using the doll, it was just not putting effort into a series and just treating the people around him so badly that no one wants to work with him anymore. And, like, really, he just was spared almost by becoming a murderer by, like, by making the mistake of, like, whiting out the eyes on the doll. So I'm glad that all the people that he cursed or was trying to curse was spared, like, you know, the terrible fates that he was, like, trying to inflict upon them. But, like, he himself is not really punished. He's just, like, lying lazily at his studio. And I don't know if he'll get more work. I don't know what's going to happen. But, like, you know, it's not a very cathartic, satisfying punishment for this character. And this character is not grown or changed as a better person or anything. So it's kind of very frustrating. Especially because, as mentioned before, the female assistant is still living with this guy, even though he cursed her, and she knows he cursed her, which is also frustrating because that he just did an awful thing to her. So
dump that piece of shit. Go find someone else.
Seriously. So overall, you know, if this still fits into the overall themes we were discussing about the ways in which, you know, our actions affect others, the burdens we place upon others, because, like, this guy's literally placing curses upon others. Much like how it was discussed, like, using the mirror in the previous story, it felt like a curse placed upon those kids. Like, in this story, like, yeah, literally the protagonist is placing curses upon others. And is, like, you know, seriously, through the course of his actions, like, affecting the lives for the worse, or just through his own, like, negligence, unintentionally affecting their lives in different ways. Like, the young assistant, because he got hungover, like, he gave the young assistants a chance to get his one-shot published and then get his series published. So, it ties into those broader themes in a way that I appreciate with the other series and collection, but as the story in and of itself, is very frustrating.
Yeah, because it's, like, very obvious you're supposed to not like him from the outset, but, like, there's no payoff to it. You want to see him, like, get punished. It never happens.
Yeah.
Yeah, that shit's funny.
How do you guys feel about The Star Has a Thousand Faces?
I was my least favorite one. Mm. It just felt very convoluted for no reason, really.
This is one, yeah, it's predicated on, like, some very flimsy, or, like, very, like, melodramatic, dramatized misunderstanding of, like, the main protagonist, who's, like, the star actress, thinks she's killed, like, her showrunner just after, like, he kind of ribs her about, like, her crush over her co-star, who, you know, is outed as, like, loving, like, you know, a different woman, a bustier woman, and so, she, you know, they're at a bar, and she, like, pushes his own, and she thinks that she broke his neck, and so she runs off into the countryside before they finish filming the final episode to, like, kill herself off by throwing herself off a cliff or whatever. And ultimately, she can't, like, bring herself to do it. And she ends up, like, staying in an inn where, like, the son of the innkeeper is, like, a huge fan of hers and has, like, all these posters in her room and stuff. And so he ends up calling the studio and letting them know that she's there. And so then, like, everyone comes to the inn to film the final scene just super impromptu, and they manage to film the scene and get it on broadcast in time somehow. See, the thing that really kind of made me taken aback by the progression of the story here is, like, the final sequence of events of, like, the other actors and the crew, like, coming to the inn and just filming the final scene, this happens, like, super abruptly. And it's also, like, she just somehow gets into the swing of, like, doing the scene. Like, because at first it seems like, oh, is it a dream sequence? But then, no, it actually is happening. And
yeah, that confused me at first.
Yeah, I thought I was, like, missing a page or something.
Yeah, that's what it was. I was like, what? Is this really happening? And then when I finished it, I was just like, oh, that really did just happen. Oh, okay.
And you have to wonder the logistics of this. Like, does the location match? Does the, like, setting match? And, like, you know, it is made a point of she memorized the lines or whatever, but still, like, she just immediately gets in a swing, and it just feels like there's a whole lot of work goes into filming a scene of a TV show in terms of just sheer setup, that it's, like, crazy to imagine how this could have been done just spur of the moment.
Yeah, they'll just fix it in the magical land of post.
Yeah, and also, like, no, see, that's the other thing, is that this is they're filming the scene literally the day this episode is supposed to air, and just hours before it's set to air, and you're left wondering, how are they supposed to edit this footage into the final episode before broadcast? And somehow that's what happens, but, like, timeline-wise, it is so confusing. Like, how they so could convoluted. Have made it work.
Yeah, exactly. It's just super convoluted and super contrived. And it's not, the payoff in the end isn't it being a ba-dunk, you know, a rim shot. Just,
yeah. It's crazy because, like, the name of it is The Star Has a Thousand Faces. Mm. And she used one. She didn't even use it because she had the mask on for half of it.
On the bright side, we did get that one panel of Sister Angela.
No, yeah, and Kikyo, too, I guess, is one of her personas. So that was a fun joke.
I did like, you know, seeing some of the some of the other Takahashi works represented, and like,
yeah, I do think those other characters are from other one shots too. So yeah, that's pretty clever. But yeah, no, in terms of like the overall storytelling of this, it just, the resolution was just very all over the place and just didn't super work connectively. In terms of how it connects with the overall team, this is another one that fits in pretty well, because like literally this woman, by like kind of going AWOL on the job, like that affects the entire production team, and so they're all scrambling to try and find where she is. And she's reflecting on, oh, like my meeting these different people kind of shaping the actress I came to be, like my connection with these people, you know, affected me as a person, what kind of person I grew into being. And then also her interacting with a fan who's like someone who's like very inspired, very in love with her work, is another reflection of like, hey, this is an impact that she as an actress has had on this person. And so, yeah, like in terms of like the overall message and in terms of like relating to the other stories of like, hey, how do we affect other people and make influence on their lives? You know, this is fits into it very well in terms of the other idea of like placing burdens on other people's interactions. Like this fits into that pretty well, but like how she kind of causes the production to scramble through, like, again, just going AWOL before they film the final scene, and then all coming together at the end to kind of, you know, connect her and reassure her that everything's going to be okay. But yeah, just in terms of like the actual like progression of the story, it's just very slipshod. It like Takashi does take a lot of cheats in just saying, oh, it just worked out. But when like logistically you are left thinking, well, how could this have possibly happened in this amount of time? Yeah.
I mean, I will say, you know, the scene with doing the Chonoichi chin, that made me laugh. Like, when the cops showed up and they're like, you know, they're looking for, like, it's implied that, like, they're looking for a woman who murdered somebody, which isn't her, since obviously the guy is alive, but she thinks she did. So, yeah, they show up and they say, they recognize her and she runs. And then, you know, and she does like this, she like juts out her chin and she's like, no, you got the wrong girl. And she runs for it. And like the you know, the cop is kind of like, oh, it's not her. I really like her. I'm a huge fan. And then I did like that.
No way. That jaw's way too big.
Yeah, that's a good gag.
I did like that gag. But yeah, otherwise, I wasn't a fan of this one.
Yeah, it was a mess.
So, but, I mean, how do we feel about Lovely Flower?
I actually kind of dig that one.
Lovely Flower is probably my favorite story in the collection because I really love the vibes and the mystery of it. And I thought that it ended up having a very clever kind of resolution. And, so the premise of this one is that this woman is, like, being harassed with, like, spam emails from a troll / stalker, and at the same time, everywhere she goes, she's seeing like this red yellow flower everywhere that she thinks smells awful, but everyone around her, all her friends, everyone she meets, seems to really love. And they all say they got it from this guy who, like, the image that they described her changes from person to person, and it all sounds like each of the people she's talking to, each of the women she's talking to describing this guy, is describing the kind of like person they are attracted to and want to sleep with. And so eventually she pieces together that the person they're describing is all the same guy, and he's leaving these flowers as an attempt to harass her and also to like kind of ultimately view her with the aroma and fragrance of the flowers. And this guy turns out to be like someone who was a co-worker of her husband's and had actually attended a lot of different like events with her. Like they were attended a class, a seminar with her. Like they were at her wedding, but she never recognized him. She never like paid him any attention or noticed him. And so that's why he like came up with this scheme to engineer these flowers that would use pheromones to attract women and specifically like kind of manipulate like their visual cortex by giving them an illusion most pleasing to them. And so how it worked with all the other women in terms of making them see the person they're most attracted to. And he's trying to use it on her, but it doesn't work on her. Like when he tries to use it on himself in front of her, he just looks like a horrible, like flower headed monster. And so
he's like, who the fuck are you? Yeah.
Who's that flower mom? Yeah.
Stop.
And so he kind of ends up, runs off, realizing that she is not working on her, and her husband also ends up coming home at that moment and kind of revealing who he is to her. And then they basically it turns out that the reason it didn't infect her is because she was pregnant and the hormones changed her sense of smell, so the pheromones didn't affect her in the same way. So, yeah. Like, this was a good kind of creepy mystery story with this imagery of, like, this woman being kind of stalked and harassed and, like, gaslit of, like, feeling like everyone's saying, oh, these flowers smell so wonderful. And they were given to me by such a handsome guy. And then she's, like, spending these flowers, like, they smell just awful to her. So repulsive, she feels like she could suffocate and die, like, being around them. She has to wear a mask, like, when interacting with them. And then, like, yeah, ultimately.
Can I sidebar real quick? Yeah. That's how I felt when everyone said they really loved the Shinjuku art in JJK. I was just like, where am I?
Sometimes it's okay to be wrong, Marriott.
Yeah.
It's okay. Oh,
it is wrong. Okay.
My personal nightmare.
That's going to be me when Chainsaw Man starts airing. Anyway, yes. Going on.
sorry.
I will admit I was kind of I wouldn't say wary, but like, I don't know what I want to say about this one. I wouldn't say I didn't like it, but the twist at the end saved it for me, because I felt like the premise was a little bit weak for me. I don't know. Like,
I thought it was pretty successful.
It wasn't really hooking my attention, but then I will I do like this in comparison to the story before it. I do like the ending, like, wraps up everything really, like, satisfactorily for me.
Yeah.
Like, I will say that much. But, like, the story itself just wasn't hooking me the way that, like, Mirror did.
Yeah. So I think I have the opposite problem where, like, it was, like, intriguing me up until the ending where it kind of just, like, quickly ends.
That's fair.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, the big reveal imagery at the end of, like, him having the flower head was very good. And I think, like, the ending kind of resolved decently. I mean, I would have liked this guy to have been, like, outright punished. But I think, like, the ironic kind of musing of, like, oh, this guy, you know, he was trying to manipulate me through using these pheromones. But it was him himself lost in the illusion, the fantasy of his own flowers. So
see, that's the punishment is what I really want out of it, I think. And because that's not there, it's not as satisfying.
I can get that, but like in this case, like, you know, the protagonist, the woman, is fine at the end. Like she, and presumably is not going to be in danger of this guy again because he gave up and moved away. So I wasn't as bothered by it as the like lack of catharsis in Revenge at all, where like, you know, the guy is not punished for being horrible, and there are like other people who he's affected that are still in his life with the like female ancestors. But yeah, no, and in terms of, again, to relating to the overall theme of the story, like this is how like the ways in which we influence or affect each other's life, like this, the woman did not recognize or realize this guy was even a part of her life, and in trying to make her recognize him, like, he really was causing her a lot of anxiety and pain and suffering. So I thought that was an interesting angle and an interesting fit into the overall theme of the stories. And yeah, I thought that It was just, in general, like, a very interesting, suspenseful read. And I thought it was very funny, like, some of the men that the girls thought Utsugi looked like. Like, one girl thought he looked like Nick Cage.
Yes.
And David Beckham. It's pretty wild, pretty funny. And one girl horny for Nick Cage is very funny to me. The idea is that they're all like that they see the person they're most horny for, right? So that's very funny.
Yes, that got me laughing a lot when they were all like different people. I mean, I guess at that point that's when I was like a little bit more interested in what's going on. Okay, why are they all seeing different people? And like I love when manga name drops like real people, like foreign, especially foreign celebrities like that.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I really love it when manga does that, because then it feels less insular, you know? A lot of times you're reading manga, when you're into manga, you don't think about it so much, but it feels very insular until, like, somebody drops Nick Cage, and you're like, oh, right, this is a product of the world.
this came out in 2003. When was Wicker Man? Nick Cage's Wicker Man. Oh, this is years before that, but still. What movie was this girl, like, super in love with Nick Cage?
National Treasure.
Knight Rider was 2004, wasn't it?
Oh, God.
But National Treasure might have been it then. I think that might have been the most recent.
Oh, God.
We're going to steal the Rafflesia of Independence.
Okay, so I guess next up is, unless we have something else we want to say, next up is we're going to Garfield and Friends.
Let's go to Ranma One Half.
Yay!
Ranma One Cat.
Yes. Yes. Thank you, Vila.
There is only one cat, too. This guy, only one of his arms is turned into a cat. So, yeah. But, yeah, like we kind of mentioned before, this has very Ranma-y vibes in terms of the main protagonist. You know, he's also a martial artist, but, like, he's this big fear of cats, because when he was a kid, his, like, grandma was, like, always telling him that cats are not to be trusted or whatever. And so that kind of put a strain on his relationship with his childhood friend, Miwa, because, you know, she has a pet cat called Torajio that's even older than her. She's been a long time pet of hers. And, you know, when they were kids, like, he climbed up a tree to get away from her and Torajio, because it was getting Torajio, and he fell off the tree and broke his, like, arm. And ever since then, even though his arm's healed now, he's fine now, like, there's been a lot of distance between him and Mia over the incident. And she kind of vents to him about him to Torchio. And then just one day, like, Torchio, like, attacks him and, like, he kind of hurts his arm before, like, disappearing. And basically, he sees a vision of him in his sleep the next night of, like, saying that he's going to curse him and take over his body. And sure enough, like, his left arm becomes a cat arm. And so he and Miwa have to, like, figure out how to kind of undo the curse and figure out what and where Torchio went. And eventually he kind of loses patience with her because there are, like, misunderstandings in which, you know, people think they're close and, you know, they're misunderstanding, like, she thinks that he hates her and he thinks she hates him. And eventually she kind of confesses that she thinks the reason that Torchio cursed him was that, you know, she hated him, and she ranted to Torchio about that, and he cleared up that, oh, well, you know, I didn't want to see you back then when we were kids after the accident, just because Torchio was at you. I did want to see you, and I never really hated you. And so then that makes her reflect that, no, she never really talked about how much she hated to Torchio. She talked about how much she liked him, and so she kind of breaks down. And then he notices he comes back to console her with his own hand and not Torchio's hand. And yeah, like, they kind of make amends. And you think, like, the reason that Torchio cursed him was because, oh, he wanted to mend their relationship after all this time. But no, the real reason, the twist is that he was just excited for his 28th birthday present. He knew that he wasn't going to live long enough to get it. So basically that's the resolution, is that that passes and his arm is back to normal. But like, yeah, now both Shuta and Miwa have kind of repaired the relationship and are friends again.
I love how the Buff the Truth box is, like, in a blood splattered, yeah, like, border.
Yeah, it's, like, setting up, like, oh, it's even more horrifying truth about why Torchio cursed him. It's like, no, it's actually such a mundane, silly reason. Superficial, yeah,
it really, reason. Like, it just reflects the age of Ranma. Just, like, it feels, I could feel this being, like, a filler episode of Ranma anime or something.
Yeah, it is totally a Ranma-type gag, for sure. This could have been a Ranma story. I totally could have believed it. Especially with, like, the dynamic between the leads. Like, it's so Ranma and Akane.
Yes, yes, especially when they're, like, he's, like, I mean, when Torchio breaks his arm when he's in high school, he's like, you know, she's apologizing, and he's like, nah, it wasn't your fault this time. He's like, excuse me, but you were the one that fell out the tree. And like, I just said, ah, oh, this is Ranma and Akane.
Yeah, even her expressions, like, really feel Akane as her, like, very much in this era of Takashi's art that, like, characterized late Ranma, early Inuyasha to me, in terms of her facial expressions, her eyes, like, yeah, they very much resemble like how I would imagine Akane to react in this kind of situation.
Yeah, especially like at the beginning where like her classmates were talking about how cute he is, and she just rolled her eyes in like the this way that just was very Ranma-ish. Like, I got like a whole nostalgia vibe from just this whole thing. Just,
yeah.
And especially just that, how easily they bought the story about how YA suddenly has a cat arm. Like, that also felt very, because one thing about Ranma, and I guess Takahashi's humor in general, is it's very dry. Like, you don't get the whole Tsukomi and Boke thing where like people are screaming about how ridiculous something is. Everybody just kind of rolls with things. And that in and of itself is what is funny.
It really does feel like, oh, like they really accept this as part of their daily life now. Like, yeah. You know, it's just the Takashi style of like in the Rumic world, like the absurd and the mundane coexist side by side.
Exactly.
Yeah. It was a pretty satisfying story.
Very charming. But yeah, I mean, we already talked about Sweet Sunday, so I guess, are there any other overall thoughts? So I guess in terms of like, again, thematic relevance to the other ones, you know, this is another one of like communication problems causing a rift between our two leads here. They not realizing how they really felt about each other and how they were affecting each other in terms of like they're keeping silent and keeping their distance from one another. And which leading to Torchio, like, you know, sensibly he has the selfish reason, but the reason imagined of like, you know, him bringing them together again after driving them apart when they were kids fulfills the intended purpose of like, yeah, and communicating with each other, and like they realize like, oh, they really do mean something to each other, you know. And so, yeah, I think it fits in pretty well with the themes of the other stories, too, in terms of, like, thinking about, like, the ways in which we affect other people and how our actions influence and are interpreted and affect other people.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Like, and, of course, it ties into the horror thing with the quasi-transformation. Yeah. And
yeah, that is a very horror scene, even though the rest of it is played for comedy. Like, it is a very bottom horror moment. And, like, when the grandmother expression, when she's in Cats Are Unforgiving, like, that's another, like, horror image that's played very well for comedic effect. Like, with her all in shadowed and stuff for her face.
Because cats are unforgiving.
It's funny how it's still less horrifying than that fucking manticore looking cat from the Renee.
Oh, what?
Oh, my God.
Which cat? You mean Rokumon?
I just hate that human face on that cat.
Yeah, Rokumon, yeah.
Rokumon's so adorable,
he's a good
though.
Boy.
He's like Shippo, but not useless.
Yeah.
God.
Shippo's so useless, it took them 40 episodes to have him show up in Yashahime.
And then even then, in the manga, it's like, it's Where's Waldo with him? You just see him pop up in a chapter, and you have to go back in the chapter and figure out where he was the entire time, because he has no presence.
But, okay, so, I mean, I guess our overall thoughts of it?
Clearly, we need to rank these stories.
This isn't a Shonen Jump podcast, so we're not... No, I'm kidding. Okay. Mirror, for me, anyway, Mirror would definitely be first. The cat would be second. Lovely Flower and the Revenge Doll. Yeah, that's how I do it. I mean, honestly, no. Sweet Sunday? No, I take that back. My Sweet Sunday would be first. Then the rest.
Yeah.
I actually liked the flower one about as much as I did the cat one. So I would they would both be tied for number two for me. I'm not including the Sunday one, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, V-Lord, do you want to go before me or should I go next? Or?
I'll go, I guess. I mean, okay. So I'm not going to include the Sweet Sunday one, because the Sweet Sunday one is just going to be at the top, I guess.
Yeah, it feels just so separate. Like, I couldn't rank it amongst the rest of these, because it's such a different type of one-shot. It's like an autobiographical reflection from Adachi and Takahashi about their careers, whereas the rest are, like, you know, short fiction stories. So, yeah, it's hard to compare.
Of course everyone's favorite part of the meal is dessert.
Come on. You know, It is a sweet Sunday, so yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I guess best to worst, Mirror, then Flower, Cat, Thousand Faces, then Doll at the bottom.
Oh, you know, I think I will have to mirror V-Lord here. I think my order is exactly the same.
Oh, nice.
For reasons I think we've discussed on the podcast pretty well, but yeah, I think that's in order of like how strong I think the stories and the themes as reflected in the stories were.
Beautiful. I'll shake on that.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And also how likable the characters are, I think, because yeah, as we descend, we're getting into like characters who are like, you know, really unlikable in terms of revenge at all, or really like kind of, you know, hard to get a sense of in Thousand Faces.
Yeah, but yeah, I'd say this is, like, worth reading if, like, not every story resonates with you, just because, like, it's interesting seeing, like, these, like, different types of stories that Takahashi does that we don't normally see.
And two-thirds of the stories are really great and well-worth reading. Like, the story start off strong with King the Mirror. It's a very thoughtful piece of social commentary. And then you get, again, the dessert, the creme of the piece is, like, My Sweet Sunday, which is just a fascinating look at manga history and the careers of two of some of the greatest artists in the business. So, I mean, if you're like a manga fan interested in like manga history, and especially in the history and the careers of these two authors, like that story alone is a selling point for this book, I think.
Agreed.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess it's time to wrap it up.
All right. Lum, why don't you have the honor of giving us all your social media so that we can, our lovely listeners can know where to find you.
Well, thank you. And I try not to take too long of this, but you can find me personally at Lomomiyasha on Twitter. And you can also find me pretty much wherever I am by the username, primarily Letterboxd and Animation Revelation Reuters and Annie List Reuters of Lomomiyasha. That's where you can find me. And you can also read my manga reviews on mangamerics.com. We got a lot of books coming in, a lot of reviews going out. I've started a review for King of the Mirror, so you can look forward to one on there, as well as other, you know, Takahashi reviews and other manga reviews. We got a lot to work on and write about. But also, of course, MangaMatters.com is the home of my flagship podcast, Manga Matters, where we discuss manga as both a medium and as an industry. And you can follow us on Twitter at Manga_Mavericks, and on every podcast platform you can think of, Apple's podcast, Spotify, Stitcher, and the like. Wherever you listen to podcasts, we're on it. And if you want more specific Rumiko Takahashi-related podcasts from me, you should definitely be checking out Lum Squad, the Yurusei Yatsura-focused podcast I do with my good friend Andrea C. Yoshimura. This is a wonderful wacky world, and we're going to talk about his first and most classic series, Yurusei Yatsura, having a lot of fun discussing Viz's releases of the manga, as well as the movies now that are on Crunchyroll and on Blu-ray from Discotech. And we're so excited to discuss about the new anime coming later this year, so we have a lot to talk about. We're really excited about our plans for the show this year, and you can find us on Twitter at @LumDiscoSquad and on every podcast I'm thinking of, like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and the like. And if you want to like support our podcast, you can head over to Patreon.com/MangaMatters, where we have like a lot of like tier options in terms of bonus podcasts that you can support, and like all the support you draw our way, you know, gives you access to early episodes of our shows and also just helps us keep making cool podcasts. And if you like the art I do for our podcasts, illustrations I do, animations, illustrations I make in general, you can find that on my Instagram at @SetArtwork.
Nice.
Sweet.
Definitely give them a follow. Check out all their stuff. Lum does amazing work.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Now, V-Lord, you get the honor of following up.
Okay, then. Yeah, people can find me on Twitter at VLordGTZ. Then I write various things for allcomic.com, as well as Tsunami Faithful. And I also am involved with a number of podcasts with these fine folks. Our biggest podcast, which is a number, like, I don't know, no, number 30, top 100, we're really big in over 40 countries somehow, the Demon Slayer podcast. On Twitter at DSlayer Podcast, we talk about Demon Slayer. So if you like Demon Slayer and want to hear some people talk about it ad nauseum, go over there. But aside from that, I'm also involved with Oversoul Shaman King podcast with Mirin Sakaki, at Shaman King Pod, and I also do the Dumb Weebs podcast over at Dumb Weebs Pod, as well as the Toonami Faithful podcast at Toonami Podcast. So check out all of those.
Nice. Sakaki.
Yo, all right. I'm honored to accept this honor. You can find me at, at WSS Talkback on Twitter, which is the weekly Shogaku Condition, where we talk about all of Shonen Sunday. So there is some Takahashi talk, but I mean, we're not quite focused on that. But yeah, you can definitely, we definitely do talk about her quite a bit. There are lots of magazine based Twitters out there, but we're the only ones that go through the entire magazine every week.
Don't you forget it.
Exactly. besides that, you can also check us out at wsstalkback.blogspot.com, which is where the blog that accompanies the Twitter, where we have translations of interviews, reviews of Sunday manga. You can definitely go check that out. And as always, I always say this, and everybody is welcome to join in. Whether it's a currently running Sunday series, or when it ended a long time ago, or anything, we are always looking for guest writers, so please, by all means, come hit us up. As Lum mentioned, there are, the Manga Mavericks podcast has different tiers. If you donate, and one of those tiers you can unlock a podcast I'm doing with my good friend Colton, Another Day, Another Adventure, at Another DB Pod. Where if it's animated and has Goku in it, we're gonna try to talk about it. And we're actually doing a pretty good job because we're in the 40s now. It feels like we just started. But yeah, we're making our way through the original Dragon Ball, and that's been a lot of fun. So please, by all means, if you want to hear those episodes early, contribute to the Manga Mavericks Patreon.
Otherwise, I mean, if you don't feel like you have to, because the episodes do come out publicly after some time, so definitely check that out. And yeah, you can find me personally at Kirobon, K-I-I-R-O-B-O-N, on Twitter. I just started Yu-Gi-Oh! Read for the first time ever. I'm more of a Yu-Gi-Oh! Fan, anime guy, so this is going to be interesting to go through. Yeah, and I got a lot of people really excited to have me read it, which is always validating. So, yeah, if you're into that, check that out. And that's where you can find me.
Nice. You can find me on Twitter at Microwavy, the E is before the V. Sometimes I contribute to the WSS Talkback blog. So if you want to see my writing, you can find it there. WSSTalkback.blogspot.com. Sometimes I also contribute writing for Toonami Faithful at ToonamiFaithful.com. And I also have my own personal blog. That's HeavensDoorknob.wordpress.com. I have not done much recently. Still super bogged at work. For those who do kind of like, I guess, keep up with what I've been doing, I recently got certified. So I'm nationally accredited pharmacy technician. So poggers.
Yeah.
Ooh.
And yeah, well, that's what I've been up to besides just general fighting COVID at work. But yeah, very, very happy about that. Thanks to all of you guys, all of my friends, and everyone else who's been supporting me along the way. It's not easy, like, working full-time and, like, trying to make the most out of your hobbies, but it's always fulfilling when I do get to spend time with you guys. So, thanks.
Of course.
And, yeah, you can find all the other podcasts I co-host in or star in or whatever, guest, frequent, whatever the phrase is, on the link in my Twitter bio. Yeah, besides that, you can find Saturday Night Shoggy on Twitter at SatNightShoggy. You can find us on your preferred podcast platform. We should be on basically all of them, most of them. Yeah, if you happen to enjoy listening to us, do rate us, leave comments if you can, give us any feedback. We have an email, right? In case people want to send like maybe longer form messages. Do we?
I think we do.
Okay, that's news to me.
just send it to the WSSTB email.
We do actually. It's satnightshoggy@gmail.com.
Poggers. Alright, do that. Yeah, I think that covers about most of it.
Alright then.
You know what I just thought of? It doesn't even make sense. No, this joke doesn't land because I was thinking about what the fuck is this story called again? The one with the cat?
Wait.
With cat?
With cat, yeah.
Yeah.
It looks like toward the end, what's his face? Shuda?
Yeah.
Shuda was trying to pet the pussy.
I'm so mad.
He was, but... Marion, why?
Yeah, I guess he was placed in one... Let's see another. Oh, boy.
Got you. Alright, good night, folks.
Alright.
What the fuck?
I can't even follow up with that one, man.